Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the furious backlash from the fossil fuel industry to the leak of a draft of Pope Francis's encyclical on global warming to be released on Thursday, and look into the incoherent and contradictory responses from Jeb Bush and other Catholic Republican candidates for the presidency. Joining us is Eric Conway, a historian of science and technology employed by the California Institute of Technology and co-author of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscure the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. We will discuss whether Republican climate deniers alarmed by the Pope's moral authority can continue calling global warming a hoax, as the latest primary entrant Donald Trump does, or flat earthers, as Ted Cruz labels those who believe global warming is real. Then we will speak with Charles Kurzman, a professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, about his recent op-ed in the New York Times, The Other Terror Threat. We will discuss last year's survey by 382 law enforcement agencies in the Police Executive Research Forum that finds the country is facing a growing threat from right-wing militias, neo-Nazis, and sovereign citizens, with 74% reporting anti-government extremism as one of the top three threats, while 39% listed Al-Qaeda or like-minded terrorist organizations as a threat. And finally, we'll examine the landslide Senate vote of 78-21 outlawing torture, which is attached to the National Defense Authorization Act that President Obama is threatening to veto. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor to Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss why the president is threatening to veto a ban on torture that he has called for. And joining us now is Eric Conway, who's an historian of science and technology employed by the California Institute of Technology, where he studies and documents the history of space exploration and examines the intersections of space science, earth science, and technological change. He's the author of the award-winning book Atmospheric Science at NASA, A History, and his latest, co-authored with Naomi Oreskes, is Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscure the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Conway.
Thanks, and thanks for having me.
And there's been a leak of a draft of the papal encyclical calling for governments around the world to act forcefully to reverse or stop or at least interdict or deal with climate change. And it's already creating a bit of a kerfuffle amongst a number of Republican candidates running for president, including, of course, Jeb Bush, who just announced the other day. He's been fairly hostile to climate change and said it was arrogant to people to say that the science was settled. But now he's sort of backing down and more or less acknowledging that there is a threat. But he does go on to say that he's a Catholic and I don't go to mass for economic policy or for things in politics. So there's a bit of hedging going on here. What's your sense of how much the moral authority of the Pope is going to stop this denial that has been going on for so long and has reached proportions of absurdity?
Well, I'm kind of glad to hear that Jeb Bush is finally learning a message that his father got back in the late 1980s, that climate change is a real problem and that we really should get on to deal with it. As to your question, the moral authority of the Pope, that's a really tough question. I'm glad to hear someone of his character and stature finally deciding that really that global warming is a problem for the world. And in particular with this Pope, his concern seems to be with the world's poorest, who will suffer the most, in my opinion, certainly from climate change, and who have the least resources with which to do it. So I'm hopeful that the Pope's encyclical will first bring aboard his own church members, because there's a lot of them, and make them interested and active in beginning to mitigate the damage of global warming.
Well, it's ironic that that both Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, senators from Florida, where they've had to build dams and levees now because of the sea level rise. Marco Rubio, of course, acknowledges climate change but denies that human activity is responsible or that governments should get involved. That doesn't make a lot of sense, does it?
Well, it makes sense from the particular point of view that this sort of line of argument that climate change is real, but we but it's not our fault, actually originates back in the 1980s, and it continues to echo around in political circles, as you see. At the same time, if Rubio and his other fellow Republican candidates believe that government shouldn't be involved, the reality is that it already is, because it's state governments that have to deal with the need to raise seawalls to reduce inundation and flooding, that have to deal with disasters that have been exacerbated by climate change, like wildfires here in California, like flooding, additional flooding from hurricanes. You know, the government's always going to be involved in those things, and as climate change gets worse, the government, state, federal, and local will become more and more and more involved, regardless of what politicians like to believe.
Well, it's very odd that a religious authority would be challenged in this way, as Jeb Bush did on Tuesday in New Hampshire, saying when he was asked about the leaked draft and that the fact that the Pope attributes the majority of the global warming in recent decades to human activity, Jeb Bush's candidate said he thinks that religion ought to be about making us better as people and less about things that end up getting into the political realm. How could this not be in the political realm, and how could this not be making us better as people? I mean, it's not so much making us better as people, it's making us, you know, continue as a species to inhabit this planet. Isn't it that dire?
Well, you can't separate religion and economic policy and values and ethics. It's simply a myth to believe you can box those little things up with little walls to keep them apart, because the belief in markets is itself based on a set of values about how humans behave and should behave, and it is this belief in unregulated markets that marks the post-Cold War GOP most deeply. And you can't expect a religious authority to ignore that, to ignore the calls for cutting social support for the poor, for example, as you see going on in U.S. politics, and that extends into climate change. It's true that climate change is a scientific fact, but whether or not to deal with it and how to deal with it has everything to do with politics and economics and yes, our values as a species. I'm glad to hear the Pope use his moral authority to bring that message to the public. We need science to tell us what can be done about climate change, but it's our values that tell us what we should do about climate change.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Conway, who's an historian of science and technology employed by the California Institute of Technology, where he studies and documents the history of space exploration and examines the intersection of space science, earth science, and technological change. He's the author of the award-winning book Atmospheric Science at NASA, A History, and his latest, co-authored with Naomi Oreskes, is Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. And your book, Merchants of Doubt, is a very important book, and I have interviewed Naomi Oreskes a couple of times. She had a role, did she not? At least the Pope and those that are generating this report that's been leaked, this encyclical, he heard from her, didn't he?
Oh, indeed. So the Pope held a fairly substantial conference and audience with very senior scientists and others involved in climate change studies, both social scientists and physical scientists. And Naomi was part of that, that effort to ensure that if the Pope did anything, it would be very soundly grounded in the science, in climate science.
So the motive, from what we can understand, of the candidates running for president and much of the Republican Party, and I guess some of the Democrats as well, particularly from the coal states, is clearly that they are protecting the interests of the fossil fuel industry. The fossil fuel industry is now hitting back at the Pope with a lobbyist for one of America's biggest coal mining companies sending out an email blast on Tuesday attacking the church leader, the Pope, for failing to promote fossil fuels as a solution to global poverty. So, you know, in terms of public relations wars, is there, you know, I guess we live in a peculiar society, doesn't it, where the truth doesn't necessarily matter. It's he who spins the truth best that wins the argument. So if that's the landscape we're dealing with, do you think that that the truth and facts will triumph over wishful thinking and denial?
Well, I think we already see that. I mean, most Americans accept the reality of climate change, and whether they accept the causation as human or not is kind of always bumping up and down above the 50, around the 50% level. And, you know, frankly, I found that statement from the coal executive to be hilarious. Let's face it, we've had coal for more than 100 years. If it was going to solve global poverty, wouldn't you think it would have done it by now?
Well, your point's well taken.
I mean, that's the way I look at it. But, yes, the spin game's important. But I think that most, again, I can only speak for Americans because I don't get outside the country nearly as much as I'd like to. But my sense here is that even most people accept its reality. And the argument is whether and how to do anything about it and how much will it cost. And that's where I actually want to see the debate. It really should be about method at this point and not about whether the thing even exists. And I've been disappointed by the GOP candidates and not grasping a hold of that.
Well, isn't that a tactic, though? If you can keep muddying the waters and saying that either the science is incomplete or the problem doesn't exist, then you don't have to address the problem.
Oh, yes, that's exactly the strategy. That's the merchants of doubt strategy in a nutshell. But it's disappointing to see them continue deploying it after, let's see, the Charney Report 1979 on the certainty of global warming. It's been a long time now.
So do you think that the Democrats can step up here and put pressure on it? If, as expected, this encyclical released on Thursday will have the impact it has, it's already gotten this ferocious backlash from the leaked documents, from the coal industry and from other Republican candidates, then that would indicate that they're kind of worried.
It would indicate to me that they're worried worldwide. Remember that while we've been talking mostly domestic American politics, the industry operates worldwide, and so does the Catholic Church, which is much more powerful in many other countries than it is here. I'm sort of curious to see what the reaction is in both here in the U.S. and outside it. Will the Democrats step up to defend it? Good, really good, interesting question. And I can think of some senators who probably can and should, and it'll be interesting to see if they do. I hope so.
But you've already got Santorum speaking up against it, Jeb Bush speaking up against it on Tuesday and hedging a little on Wednesday, and Marco Rubio, as we said, basically saying that he believes in global warming, but not that it's caused by humans, which is a non-statement, not to mention it's nonsensical. But we haven't heard yet from Ted Cruz, Bobby Jindal, and others. There's a number of Catholics obviously running. In terms of Catholics on the Democratic side, I don't know that, I guess there's only one candidate that people expect to win, and that's Hillary Clinton. And Bernie Sanders, of course, has been talking about it for the longest time, and he's been, if anybody, a champion on it. From the work that you've done and Naomi Oreskes have done on this, has this denial industry, we know it's been funded by the fossil fuel industry, and they basically have found a few kind of academic whores that will put out their propaganda, but it seems like they're simply running out of steam. There aren't too many people left that could call themselves scientists who put out this nonsense. It's sort of really all that's left now are politicians. Am I correct in that?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to call them whores exactly. As Naomi and I argued in Merchants of Doubt, they're true believers. They really believe in the glories of free markets, and they have allowed those political beliefs to warp their understanding of and their interpretation of the facts available. But you're right that you're seeing fewer and fewer of any stature who are really willing to stand up and present themselves as the opposition scientists. And that's not surprising, because you see this in any kind of major scientific controversy. There's always a few people who just can't give it up, and they just wind up marginalized. And marginalized people get less attention.
Well, but ironically, though, if that's the trend line, that nobody that can claim to be a scientist or have any academic stature can put their name or put forth a study that has any credibility, there's less and less of that. And even if, as you say, they're not necessarily academic whores, they may be true believers in the marketplace. Science is about facts and not about conjecture or faith. But the thing that's really disturbing is that there seems to be, in our political world, at the most important places, really active climate deniers. Jim Imhoff, in charge of the Senate panel, and his House equivalent, is also a climate denier. So both science committees in the House and Senate are chaired by climate deniers.
But we've seen this distancing of politics from science over the last few generations going on anyway, and it doesn't really start with climate change. There used to be a high-level presidential science advisory committee started by in the Eisenhower administration and dismantled in the Nixon administration over scientists' opposition to the ballistic missile defenses, of all things. And so I think that whenever you wind up seeing a particular branch of science become opposed to a strongly held political goal, you see this kind of attack on the science and this sort of distancing of the political system and science. And what concerns me is that, while I bring up the ABM issue from 1970, that was kind of a single issue amidst lots of areas of broad agreement. And what bothers me now isn't just the political opposition amongst the GOP to climate change, but you see it in many other areas. And that drift or run away from science by one party in particular, it should really be disturbing in a bipartisan system, because it means it's very, very difficult to make good policy with such united opposition to the scientific underpinnings of any policy.
Well, and particularly ironic given that the Republican Party, its first leader was Abraham Lincoln, of course, created the first national park, and the Teddy Roosevelt, of course, famous invented conservation, if you like. Richard Nixon created the EPA. So this party has fallen away from its hallowed roots, I'm afraid.
Oh, yes. And that's what I would say in response to that is what's interesting about the studies when you dig into the history pre-1970 is what you see is disagreement over how best to go about protecting the environment. In other words, there are arguments over method. And since 1970, they've become increasingly about over whether there's any need to protect the environment. But as far as I can see, nobody in 1970 thought there was any controversy about environmental decline. It was taken as a given, and we argued over how to fix it. And it's too bad to see that one party has run so far away from that sort of broad consensus.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Eric Conway.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Conway. He's an historian of science and technology employed by the California Institute of Technology, where he studies and documents the history of space exploration and examines the intersections of space science, earth science, and technological change. He's the author of the award-winning book Atmospheric Science at NASA, A History, and his latest co-authored with Naomi Oreskes is Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. We can take a brief station break and back looking into how America's police forces see right-wing domestic terrorism as a greater threat than Islamic terrorism.
There's been a crash on the levee and mama, you've been refused. Well, it's king for king and it's queen for queen. It's gonna be the meanest flood that anybody's ever seen. Whoa! Mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now. You're gonna have to find yourself again.
America's
Not a poor Ku Klux man. See that we are brothers. Not 'cause things the same, but 'cause we like the same color. And that's gray, now that's Maine. Can't burn his cross 'cause he can't afford the gasoline. Now if a Muslim woman strapped with a bomb on the bus with the seconds running give you the jitters, just imagine an American-based Christian organization planning the poison water supplies to bring the second coming quicker.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Charles Kurzman, a professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director of the Carolina Center for the Study of the Middle East and Muslim Civilizations. He's the author of The Missing Martyrs and The Unthinkable Revolution in Iran, and editor of the anthologies Liberal Islam and Modernist Islam, 1840 to 1940. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, The Other Terror Threat. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kurzman.
Thank you.
And, of course, as you point out in your recent opinion piece in the New York Times, that if you follow the news, you would think that the country was being overrun by fanatical Muslims attacking right, left, and center. But the research that you've done, particularly looking at the Police Executive Research Forum, indicates otherwise. So walk us through some of these extraordinary statistics that show how the real threat in terms of terrorism in the United States is not from Muslim extremists, but from right-wing American extremists.
Yes, so we did this survey through the Police Executive Research Forum of 382 law enforcement agencies. That's municipal, county, and state level all around the United States, covering 86% of the U.S. population, and asked them what do they think are the greatest threats of violent extremism. And interestingly, and this may be surprising to some folks around the country, they listed right-wing anti-government extremism as a considerably greater threat than Islamic extremism.
So why do you think there is this focus then in the media and in the government, frankly, that the Muslims are a threat, Al-Qaeda, even though now there's a lot of evidence that Al-Qaeda barely exists, but the Islamic State, Al-Nusra, Al-Shabaab, whatever, they seem to be always being rattled off when anything in terms of terrorism is likely to happen. And yet there is this ongoing threat, which goes back obviously before the Oklahoma City bombing, but was certainly made very clear then. And I recall at the time that incident was initially blamed on a couple of hapless Jordanians. So is there just a sort of reflex out there that somehow gives American homegrown right-wing terrorists a free pass?
I don't know if it's a free pass, but I think there's a long tradition of political violence in the United States, as in you know, all around the world, on all sides. And right-wing and anti-government violence have a long tradition in this country. And they pop up into the media every so often. They pop up as part of the national narrative. Certainly that was true 20 years ago when the Oklahoma City bombings were accurately laid at the feet of these right-wing extremists. That said, I think these days we tend to have this grand narrative of America being under threat from overseas, and we focus on these civil war zones with horrific violence in Syria, in Iraq, and a handful of other countries involving Muslims, and the narrative seems to involve then the fear that that violence is somehow going to be transferred here into the United States. So incidents that occur where there are Muslim extremists in the U.S., and they do engage in plots and occasionally actually carry out acts of violence, too, those are part of this broader story, I think, this broader fear, whereas these anti-government incidents, aren't quite as big of a public concern, at least at the political level, at the media level. Although, as I mentioned, as we found in this survey, law enforcement seems to be focused on distinctly on those kinds of threats.
Well, just to quote from your recent New York Times article, just to give a contrast and a context here. Since 9/11, an average of 9 American Muslims per year have been involved in an average of 6 terrorism-related plots against targets in the United States. Most were disrupted, but the 20 plots that were carried out accounted for 50 fatalities over the past 13 and a half years. In contrast, right-wing extremists averaged 337 attacks per year in the decade after 9/11, causing a total of 245 fatalities. And by the way, the source for this study is not some liberal think tank, but the United States Military Academy at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center.
Yeah. Now, they use a different definition than there's all sorts of definitional issues, and other accounts come to different totals, depending on what you count as ideological violent extremism. But the general point, yes, is that there are more attacks and more fatalities from anti-government right-wing fringe elements than from Muslim fringe elements. But the bigger point as well, I would say, is that both forms, all forms of violent extremism, are a drop in the bucket when we consider the amount of violence in the United States that we endure year after year, more than 14,000 murders a year. Political violence, fortunately, is a really small amount of that, portion of that. And so focusing on all of this extremism, it seems to me, gets us away from taking care of and trying to prevent and reduce the overall level of violence in the country.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Kurzman, who's a professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director of the Carolina Center for the Study of the Middle East and Muslim Civilizations. He's the author of The Missing Martyrs and The Unthinkable Revolution in Iran and editor of the anthologies Liberal Islam and Modernist Islam, 1840 to 1940. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, The Other Terror Threat. And just to put that last remark into context, terrorism of all forms, which is quoting from the article, of all forms has accounted for a tiny proportion of violence in America. There have been more than 215,000 murders in the United States since 9/11. For every person killed by Muslim extremists, there have been 4,300 homicides from other threats. So that's the landscape of violence here in the United States. So, and of course, that we won't go into an argument about the Second Amendment, but certainly the availability of weapons, the means to kill, have to be a big factor. And one of the great ironies, of course, in the post Osama bin Laden 9/11 era is that in the handbook, the Al-Qaeda handbook that was captured in Afghanistan shortly after the U.S. invaded following 9/11, part of the content of that handbook was, if you are going to conduct a terrorist attack in the United States, do not bring the weapons into the country with you. There are plenty of weapons available in the United States off the shelf.
It's certainly true that weapons, handguns and long guns are a major means of violence in the United States and a large portion of the toll. Let's keep in mind, though, that the number of murders is down now. It used to be 24,000 murders per year in the United States 2 decades ago. That's gone down since the early 1990s and is now about 14,000. So even though that number is extremely large, it is considerably lower than it used to be. It seems hard to imagine that we're living in relatively peaceful times, but that's what the data show, that there's not that many civil wars around the world. There's not that many wars between governments. People are living longer, and murder rates are down in most countries, including the United States. But we have access now to instant news of violence around the country, around the world, and I think we're sort of scaring ourselves silly those of us who follow the news are getting a disproportionate sense of the prevalence of violence out there because it's brought onto our screens in such a rapid way.
But what I think is important about the research that you've done and the article that you co-authored with David Chanza in the New York Times is from this Police Executive Research Forum last year of 382 law enforcement agencies, 74% reported anti-government extremism as one of the top three terrorist threats in their jurisdictions. 39% listed extremism connected with Al-Qaeda or like-minded terrorist organizations. And only 3% identified the threat from Muslim extremists as severe compared with 7% for anti-government and other forms of extremism. So at least in this country, the people who have to deal with this threat on the ground, the first responders, if you will, are aware of it, right? Our press and our public and our politicians may not be putting it into context, but police forces seem to be.
Yes, and keep in mind there's both single digits for the folks of all types of terrorism, Islamic or right-wing, single digits for the law enforcement agencies rating that as a severe threat. But yes, the relative ratio seems to be consistent across all types of law enforcement agencies, from rural districts to major cities, and a statistically significant difference. So we're finding law enforcement does seem to have its eye on the ball on this issue.
But in terms of, we sort of vaguely know what drives Muslim extremists, even though President Bush said they hate us for what we stand for, rather than what we do in terms of our foreign policy. But I think there's enough information out there to give you some idea of what motivates, and particularly with the Islamic State getting so many recruits from the diaspora in Europe, there's a lot of coverage on that. But there's very, very scant coverage on what motivates right-wing anti-government terrorists in this country. Even at the time of Timothy McVeigh, I don't recall any real insight into what makes these people tick and why they feel so alienated from the very society that they live on, that live in, that they feel they have to mete out violence against their own society. In this article of yours at the New York Times, you say, an officer from a large metropolitan area said that militias, neo-Nazis, and sovereign citizens are the biggest threat we face in regard to extremism. So, having identified the threat, has anybody identified the pathology?
I don't think there's a single path towards violent extremism, and that's what the literature seems to show. Everybody has their own theories. There are many paths, some of them recruitment into organizations, these fringe organizations. Others seem to be what folks call lone wolves, individuals who self-radicalize or who have their own personal problems that lead them to engage in violence. I don't think that there's a single pathway that leads people to engage in this kind of violence. What they have in common is this ideology, a general sense of an ideology that the government is a huge part of the problem, is oppressive and needs to be responded to with force, and that, so there's targeting of law enforcement, targeting of government officials in some of these instances. And the other idea, which is common to revolutionary movements of a variety of sorts, a variety of ideologies, is that targeting innocent civilians can bring about a sort of apocalyptic crescendo of violence that will lead to some sort of cleansing and renewal and a new form of government, perhaps. That kind of spectacular violence is common to terrorism of all sorts. The idea that you need to frighten people through seemingly random acts of violence in order to affect the broader society. I think it's interesting to see how that tactic can jump from one ideology to another. So you see some folks using tactics from totally separate ideological movements where they wouldn't share the goals at all, and yet they share some of the means, including the use of pipe bombs and IEDs and other sorts of explosives by groups that have nothing to do with the folks who perfected these in civil war zones overseas.
But in terms of the ideology as opposed to the actions themselves, and obviously there's a big distinction between people who have belief systems and those that act on them in an extreme way. But when you mentioned anti-government sentiment, well, I mean, that's the Tea Party. It's a part of our political life. And I recall when there was a school kid down in Kentucky a few years ago shot up a schoolyard and killed some of his fellow students when they went to his apartment or home. They found a whole bunch of right-wing authors, and including Bill O'Reilly and others, ranting about the government, etc. And they, of course, were very indignant that there was any relationship. So where is the line between, when you talk about the apocalyptic nature of what drives, whether it's the Islamic State or anti-government militias here in the United States, you know, the apocalyptic end of times is, I think, one of the best sellers. I think they've sold something like 60 million copies. So obviously there's a line between that kind of political ideology and acting on it. But is there any responsibility, you think, in terms of our public discourse?
Well, as you mentioned, let's not tarnish a large sector of American political life with the actions of this tiny fringe violent, you know, extremists. Even if they may share some ideological beliefs, I don't believe that we should be blaming the Tea Party for the actions of these fringe individuals, just as we shouldn't blame, say, Muslim critics of U.S. foreign policy for the actions of a handful of people who may go off the deep end and engage in violence on that basis. So, yeah, there may be ideological similarities, but there's a big difference between complaining about something and engaging in violence over it. And I think that's a pretty bright line. and we ought to maintain that line.
Absolutely. But in terms of, though, what's the genesis, though, do you think, of and the alienation? Because I think that that's probably the one consistency here, whether it's young Muslims in London feeling alienated from their own society and feeling they have to go off to Syria and fight jihad, and young Americans like Timothy McVeigh. The only thing that I see in common is this deep sense of alienation. And here in the United States, we have a government that, you know, according to the Declaration of Independence, if the government becomes destructive of the ends of the people, for the people, and by the people, it's the right of the people to overthrow it. So I'm curious to know where that sense of alienation comes from and disengagement in a society that where there is the opportunities of the citizens, whether they take it up or not, in terms of engaging in politics, to engage in politics.
Yes, Declaration of Independence is sometimes cited by some of these violent extremists as justification for calling for a new revolution, one that would restore what they see as some sort of pre-constitutional rights. This feeling of alienation that the country has gone down a drastically wrong path is something that many of these extremists share. It comes from a sense that they're not getting their way at the ballot box, that they feel that there have been all sorts of tricks perpetrated on them in our electoral system, in our political system, and so they want to shortcut all of that and restore what they see as a just system through violence. It's a fascinating thing, the phrase pre-constitutional rights. It comes up in a few of these cases of right-wing violence. The idea that there's sort of natural rights that are inherent in individuals, sometimes they cite medieval English common law for the justification of this, and say that municipal and federal authorities are totally unjustified, whereas county authorities, because they have some sort of mythic link with medieval English society, are considered more legitimate. And so they might go after police officers, but not after a sheriff's deputy. And we've seen a number of these cases, you know, really unusual ideologies. There's some folks call themselves sovereign citizens who refuse to get license plates because they believe they have a pre-constitutional right to use their own private property, their vehicle. And so they'll make their own license plates or traveler's permits. And there's been a couple incidents of violence when law enforcement has pulled folks over because they don't have a proper license plate on. And, you know, most of the time it does not end up in violence, but occasionally it has. And there's actually been more than 24 law enforcement officers killed by right-wing extremists over the last couple decades.
Well, just in closing, it seems like such an interesting irony that I was quoting the Declaration of Independence, where it said, you know, government deriving their just powers from the assent of the governed. And if the government becomes destructive of these ends, it's the right of the people to overthrow it and replace it. Citing that as an example of a built-in outlet, if you will, for legitimate grievance and change and revolution, as opposed to violent revolution. But isn't it interesting? I suppose that example.
That everybody thinks their grievances are legitimate, right?
Right. Yeah, but the idea that what seems to me to be a built-in outlet or a pathway to revolution is considered a permission slip for violent revolution.
Yeah, well, revolution is unconstitutional, right? The Constitution was sort of the ending point of that revolutionary period. It's like, now we have procedures, no more rebellions, please. And so they went ahead and put down rebellions that came out after that. That's part of American history. We have that streak in us, a rebellious streak. And I think that it generates all sorts of wonderful political forms of protest and so on. Of course, when it turns violent, it can be pretty nasty. And I think that's what we're seeing here in this study, as law enforcement is concerned about these groups on the right, as well as Islamic groups to a lesser extent, that have taken this turn towards violence.
Well, Charles Gersman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Charles Kurzman, who's a professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and the co-director of the Carolina Center for the Study of Middle East and Muslim Civilizations. He's the author of The Missing Martyrs and The Unthinkable Revolution in Iran and editor of the anthologies Liberal Islam and Modernist Islam, 1840 to 1940. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, The Other Terror Threat. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the landslide Senate vote of 78 to 21 outlawing torture.
Already gone. You can write my whole life down in a little book. Well, already gone. I've started shaking and my heart breaking and my belly crawls. The Jesus fever's falling all over you, believers and lovers.
Yeah, I see my light cook shining from the west out to the east. Any day now, any day now, I shall be released.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who is a professor at Columbia Law School and is a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And Scott, this vote that took place a couple of days ago in the Senate, 78-21, outlawing torture, was a real landslide. And you could tell that Dianne Feinstein and John McCain, who brought the amendment together, were quite happy with the response. It's pretty unusual to get that kind of vote in this very polarized political environment. But the odd part about it is it's being attached to the National Defense Authorization Act. And even though it's based upon President Obama's executive order, which came into play when he entered the White House in 2009, banning a torture that took place under the Bush administration, and restricting government employees, including CIA agents, to only use techniques specified in the Army Field Manual, that he's going to veto it. So what's going on?
Well, his veto threat, and I have to say, if we go back the last 3 years, every year President Obama has threatened to veto the NDAA, and he hasn't done it. But every year it also focuses on the same thing. So what one main point has to do with the sequester, that is this agreement that the budget is going to be capped and they're not going to exceed it. And this legislation essentially says we're going to exceed spending just for the military, but not for anything else. So the Obama White House doesn't agree with that. And then secondly, they're clearly also trying to block Obama's attempts to shut down Guantanamo by placing hurdles in the way of his releasing prisoners or transferring prisoners out of Guantanamo. So it's that has drawn the veto threat rather than the anti-torture provisions.
Well, that sounds a bit disingenuous on the part of the Senate, isn't it? I mean, I don't mean to sound naive, but, you know, on the one hand, you're doing something that you're congratulating yourself about and it's the right thing to do, and you're trying to sort of overcome the terrible stain that this country has inflicted upon itself from the Bush administration. But at the same time, you're playing all those kind of games. And I understand that there is a real battle going on with Harry Reid and Senator Murray, who originally negotiated, or a couple of years ago, negotiated a sequester deal with Paul Ryan, where they made equal cuts from defense and domestic spending. And remember, the sequester was an insane thing, and everybody thought it was the craziest thing you could possibly do. It was meant to sort of make them get real about the budget, But instead, the Republicans have played this trick where they're basically hiding something like $100 billion in defense contingency slush funds while cutting everything on the domestic side. So, and then you bring up Guantanamo. That's another poison pill. So go ahead. Sorry, I mean, I'm going.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think this issue with the sequester has been back there, has been in the background for several years, but it's coming to a boil in a much more serious way right now. And I think the principle, the White House is prepared to live with the original deal that was struck with Paul Ryan. That is a cap on both defense and domestic spending. And the Republican leadership is busting the deal by expanding the defense spending dramatically while trying to hold the cap on the domestic spending. And I think the White House feels that that's unfair, and so does the Democratic leadership. So in the end, could we actually have a veto? I think there's some risk of that. But at the end of the day, this is military authorization. And at the end of the day, the military budget has to clear Congress, has to be voted through. This is one of the few pieces of legislation that always works its way through. So I imagine that after conference, we're going to see some quick maneuvering to find a way to satisfy the White House and the Democrats.
Well, the whole sequester is premised on the idea that the country has a burdening deficit that has to be dealt. It's crippling the country, and it's a complete myth. I mean,
it's untrue. There is no. In fact, we've had more reduction of deficit under this president than any other recent president, other than Bill Clinton.
So they're basically just using this device to strip away domestic spending and to reward the Pentagon. In a time when America's getting out of wars.
Well, even more to the point, in the end of the day, it's rewarding military and intelligence contractors who contribute very heavily to our election cycle.
So that, do you think that's a big a part of this? You mentioned the intelligence contractors. In terms of the pushback coming from Senator McConnell, there were only 21 that voted against it, but if there's a veto or if there's a compromise done, can they throw this bill under the bus?
No, they will not. I think there will be tremendous pressure on the Republicans to get the bill through, because today, I mean, the situation today is very different from the situation in the 1970s, where the defense budget went straight to the Pentagon and went to uniformed military personnel. Today, our budget goes overwhelmingly into the hands of contractors.
So, in terms of though the intention of Feinstein, Senator Feinstein, who really did put up a good fight to get that report through, and the CIA fought her tooth and nail forever, and she's managed to get a 500-page. Digest of the report, which was, 6,300 pages, a lot of it which was redacted. Do you think that the country has learned the lesson? I mean, I can't help relating to what just happened in South Africa, and as an example, where Omar Bashir, the murderous leader of Sudan, responsible for genocide, escaped arrest from the International Criminal Court because of his cronies in the African Union, particularly Jacob Zuma in South Africa, having contempt for the rule of law, which is exactly what happened with Bush and Cheney by instigating torture. They gave permission to every seedy tin pot dictator around the world to basically say, what are you Americans complaining about? You know, you have a double standard. You guys do, you torture now, so what's the big deal? I mean, that to me is the greatest loss that the U.S. has faced because of the torture regime.
Well, certainly after that report came out, we had a number of former CIA people say, it'll die the death, you'll never hear anything from it, there'll be no reforms. And in fact, notwithstanding the obstruction of CIA leaders and representatives, we see now this major piece of legislation going through, the import of which is to turn Obama's anti-torture executive order into law and to make it applicable to the CIA. That's one of the major changes in this bill. So we are seeing some clear action on this, and that is notwithstanding the opposition of the CIA and without any support coming from the White House. So it's quite a feat for Dianne Feinstein and for John McCain.
And do you think that that there is, though, the fact that the vote was so overwhelming, do you think that as a country that we're sort of expiating here, the example I cited as the damage done to our reputation, which has given permission to every dictator on the earth to basically go ahead and torture with impunity, because after all the Americans do it, to me that's a huge consequence. What consequences do you see, since you work in human rights issues on the international stage?
Well, I think this is a very high-profile, important case, but of course there are many other scenes where this is being played out. I mean, one of them right now is across Europe, in Germany and Poland and Italy and Spain, where there are investigations ongoing into what happened in these black sites. And what we see going on there, as was recently reported by Reuters out of Poland, the prosecutors in Poland say the U.S. Justice Department is refusing cooperation. It's stonewalling them. That's also what prosecutors in Germany, Italy, and Spain previously reported. So, you know, we've got some symbolic victories. We have a long way to go on many other fronts.
And do you think that that the CIA that fought tooth and nail against Dianne Feinstein and her committee and ended up snooping on the committee to find out what they had in terms of documentation and where they may have gotten it from, and you recall that that John Brennan, the head of the CIA, basically lied and said that they hadn't done it, and then they had to admit that they had done it. And so is this same CIA going to basically accept the vote, an overwhelming vote? Do they recognize that the American people have spoken through the...
I think, you know, one of the major questions is a question of personnel. And within the CIA today, as several senators pointed out, one of the most disturbing facts is that people who are guilty consistently of wrongdoing, who involve themselves in torture and abuse, rose to the top of that agency and had the support of John O. Brennan. So we're probably going to have to see some change in the upper echelons of the agency before we get an attitude of compliance. And one thing we have to worry about, too, having seen what happened during the Bush administration, is that a future administration coming in may very well be able to play the same sorts of games with the law, even notwithstanding the fact that every loophole they identified and exploited has now been closed.
Well, there's a sort of a bromance going on, isn't there, between Obama and John Brennan? I mean, I could understand from Obama's point of view, the last thing he wants is a terrorist attack on the United States. That would be catastrophic, not just for the country, but although he is a lame duck, I suppose, you know, arguably, but still, it's something that he's clearly being concerned about. But what's your understanding of the extent of that relationship? Because, you know, I think it was Rodriguez and Company, wasn't it? He wrote a book proudly telling how all this torture worked. Evidence indicate that none of it worked. And then, 92 torture tapes were destroyed? And as far as I know, nobody's been held accountable?
I think that's exactly right. And I think right at the core of this is John O. Brennan. And I think we should be under no illusions. You know, it's his close personal rapport with President Obama that has produced this no accountability environment in Washington. I mean, it's not only no accountability for people who destroyed these tapes, who were also involved in torture and even homicides, even several deaths of individuals prison. So it's not only that there was no accountability, but the people who were involved in this misconduct were promoted to the highest echelons of the agency.
So how do you think this is going to translate into the current political campaign, given that this is cleaning up the mess from George W. Bush's and Dick Cheney's regime that instigated torture and brought about this disgrace that the country's still trying to get out from under? I noticed on Tuesday in New Hampshire, Jeb Bush was asked on Sean Hannity's Fox program about it. He said, I think it was appropriate at the time, but I don't think we need it now. And then, of course, Marco Rubio said he missed the vote, but he would have opposed the torture ban. Lindsey Graham, by the way, voted against it, even though he's quite close to John McCain. And then Rand Paul and Senator Ted Cruz voted for it. They're kind of all over the map, aren't they?
They are, and I think one thing we see is that the primary process leads the Republicans generally to take more aggressive positions positions that are less respectful of human rights and civil liberties, with the exception principally of Rand Paul and to a lesser extent Ted Cruz. One thing that I think John Oliver pointed out, he went to all of the 11 candidates, I guess now 12 or 13 candidates, and asked them last week whether they would continue the Obama executive order, which of course has now become law through this act in the Senate, or is about to become law. And he could not get a single one of them to say, yes, they will continue it. So I think that shows that for most of the Republicans, this isn't a positive issue. This is a difficult issue, and also putting distance between themselves and George Bush is a very difficult proposition. So I think the only candidate so far who's done that clearly is Rand Paul. I have to say now Donald Trump. Of course, Donald Trump has had brickbats for everybody, including George W. Bush.
I don't know that any proclamation coming from him is of earth-shattering importance. But is just at the end of the day, though, in closing here, is it still out there in the land, Scott Horton, that real men pull fingernails?
Well, there's certainly a group of people who watch 24 and who think that that's true. And I think the public opinion polling tells us that we now have a majority of Americans who accept that waterboarding, for instance, is torture, but also a plurality of Americans who think it may be useful, whereas the evidence now clearly shows it isn't and it hasn't been.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.